Over the decade, there has been growing bipartisan consensus on the need for prison reform. U.S. prison systems are seen as, in many cases, ineffective or broken due to the relatively high recidivism rates among the released prisoners who reoffend and wind back behind bars. So when the research and grant-making organization Open Philanthropy Project started a grant program for criminal justice reform and asked itself the sensitive and complex question, are we doing the right thing? To answer that question, it sought out its senior advisor, David Rudman. His report is titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime. David, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
Well, explain for us what the Open Philanthropy Project is and why criminal justice reform is an area of focus for this organization.
The Open Philanthropy Project is basically a new foundation. It's based in San Francisco. I actually live in Washington, D.C., so I work from home. And most of the financing right now comes from one of the founders of Facebook, not the famous one, Mark Zuckerberg, but his college roommate, Dustin Moskovitz, and his wife, Carrie Tuna. And we're looking to involve ourselves in causes that we think can improve the lives of lots of people and that look politically tractable right now and that other funders are not paying much attention to. And when we apply those criteria, one of the causes that we've been drawn to in the last few years is what's called criminal justice reform, trying to make policing and the court system, criminal court system, work better for people, and in particular, reduce the number of people that are in prison. The United States is the world champion when it comes to putting people in prison, putting its own citizens in prison. We have more than 2 million people behind bars in this country, far ahead of China. I could be wrong in saying we're the champion. There's one exception that might beat us, and that's North Korea. We don't have good data there. But they have a lot of people in prison, too. And that's not the kind of company it seems like we ought to be keeping. It seems like there's something wrong with this picture. And one reason we're drawn to this issue, as I think you said, is there's interest in on both the left and the right in doing something about how big our prison system has grown. I think for people on the left, they're concerned about, of course, not that people are only one or the other, but from the left, you get a concern about the inequity of the system. It seems to ensnare people of color, poor people, much more. And on the right, you get more concern about the size of government. Prisons cost a lot of money. And about prisons as an instrument for depriving citizens of liberty. It seems kind of a concerning thing when a democracy is putting this many of its own people behind bars.
So what question did you set out to answer?
I had a very specific question. We had already pretty much decided, based on talking to a lot of people and reviewing the research that was available to us, that we wanted to get involved in this area. But, you know, you can always learn more. And so we were concerned that maybe we were getting this wrong. What if we succeeded in reducing the number of people trapped in prison, and that caused a big crime spurt? That not something we would want to happen. Our sense was that that would not happen, but that it would be worth looking more closely at that. So I was asked to review the research that's available right now on this question. Would reducing the number of people in prison increase crime or reduce it or leave it about the same? And so I spent almost a year going through some of the best studies and in some cases even rerunning them to decide whether I thought I could trust the way the numbers had been crunched.
Interesting you would rerun studies that have already been done. Why did you decide to go that route? And what did you find when you replicated studies?
That's a great question, because not many people do this to the depth that I do. It's considered a little bit impolite, I think, within academia for one person to take apart a colleague's work. I did it in part because it's just how I'm born. You know, it fits my personality to really dig into things. But it comes from within, from a sense that if I'm going to, you know, make the best recommendation that I can, announce it publicly, hope that it influences the work of my colleagues who are working in this area, I have to have analysis that I can believe. And I've learned through experience that, you know, a lot of these studies, they start to look weaker when you really dig in. They can be if you can't when you actually read a paper, you're not looking at the numbers. You're looking at somebody writing about the numbers, and they're always leaving a lot out, whether it's consciously or unconsciously. And there's often more to the story.
Oh, and there's kind of a skew, perhaps a bias, even in showing exactly numbers and hard data, but in the way it's written.
Sure. I mean, There are all kinds of biases. Some of us have different views on, on crime and punishment in this country and want to get to a different conclusion. There's also, if you're a young professor trying to get tenure, you must get published. And the better the journal you get published in, the better. And often what helps you get published is finding a non-zero effect, whether it's positive or negative. If you find that A doesn't really affect B, that's not an exciting paper and won't help you get published. Mm. So there's really intense incentive to try different things until something pops out and seems to be a real pattern. But, if you check for enough patterns, even in noisy data where there's nothing, you will eventually find something just by chance, and then that can get played up.
So you reviewed some of the research already out there. What were some of the shocking findings?
Shocking findings.
Okay. What stuck out?
Yeah. Sorry, what?
What stuck out to you?
Okay. Let me say, there's a standard way of thinking about this question. Does imprisonment affect crime, that at first I resisted and then realized was actually very helpful. This is sort of a preface. We can think about the effects of putting someone in prison as, in terms of the before effects, the during effects, and the after effects. When a legislature, like there in Wisconsin, may have done, raises sentences for robberies or for drug crimes, that might deter crime. People will say, whoop, better avoid the drug business. And that's the before effect. Then there's the during effect, which is when somebody's in prison, it's much harder for them to commit crime outside of prison. And that's a real thing. And then there's the after effect. Does having been in prison make you more or less likely to commit crime once you get out? One thing I wasn't expecting is that the evidence is pretty clear that there's essentially no deterrent effect. The various laws have been passed in the last 20 or 30 years to tighten, to toughen sentences, put people in prison longer. And I just came away convinced that that had done essentially nothing to reduce crime.
If you're just joining us, David Rudman is our guest. He is senior advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project, which is a grant-making foundation based in California. He did a year of research, recently released a report titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think incarceration reduces crime? Why or why not? Do you think this country has an incarceration problem or a crime problem? Join in the conversation. Ask questions. 800-642-1234. David, when you replicated some of these studies, you found some errors, some sloppiness in the data. What did you find?
Yeah. It gets pretty technical pretty quickly. I don't know if I would call it sloppiness per se. These studies were thoughtfully done, although they were, I think, probably, distorted in the way I mentioned before. There is a lot of pressure, especially on young researchers, to find the interesting, surprising result. What's a good example? One problem that we have with crime data in the United States is that there's a lot of missing data. If you really want to, you can download number of different kinds of crimes by month and police agency for the entire country back to 1960, and it's a really big data set. The problem is there's a lot of missing numbers in there where the agencies just never, sent their data to the FBI. And so then if you want to analyze this data, you got to figure out, do you want to just drop those cities from your study, which could bias the results because they no longer represent the United States? Or do you want to make some guesses about what should go in those empty cells? And so in one case, I reviewed a study that looked at deterrence. That's the before effect that I mentioned just a minute ago. And I took what I thought was a more systematic and now generally seen as a more reliable method for dealing with these data gaps. And when I did that, the what before looked like a sharp drop in crime after sentences were toughened smoothed out. And you know, I wasn't necessarily expecting that, but it made me feel like this was something of you know, sort of a chance finding that had been dramatized.
David Rudman is with us. He ran the numbers and replicated a number of the reports on prison and incarceration. He's a senior advisor to the Open Philanthropy Project. He stays with us. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you think incarceration reduces crime? Why or why not? Do you think the tough on crime approach works in your city? Join the conversation, 800-642-1234. We'll return after a news update. The U.S. is the world's leader in incarceration, spending $52 billion a year on correctional supervision and another $948 billion in related social costs. That's data from the Bureau of Justice Statistics back from 2011. We're breaking down the numbers this hour to better understand the impact of prison reform. Locking up fewer people, does that make sense in making Americans safer? David Rudman has examined all sides of that question as senior advisor to the San Francisco-based Open Philanthropy Project. His report, it's titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime. Your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. Have you ever been imprisoned? What's been your perception of sentencing? How do you think America should address prison and crime? 800-642-1234. Let's go to Chris now in Glenwood City. Hi, Chris.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I grew up in Lake Norman City, which is South Minneapolis, St. Paul, and in a very stable home. Had good values instilled in me, but still the temptation with a lot of us.
Yeah. Chris, you're really breaking up. It's really hard to understand you. I'm going to try to have you go ahead one more time.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, a little better. Go ahead.
Okay, I'm a 67-year-old guy. I lived up to the 60s when there was a lot of stuff going on. I've got friends of all color. We're all Americans. But where I think the problems start is at home, that there's too many single-parent families where there isn't instilled in the kids self-respect, respect for others, and understanding that there's consequences for your actions. I went beyond the lines a few times. I've been in a few county jails, and it's a wide, wide opening experience. If people could really see that, it would change things immensely. But where it has to start in my mind is in the homes and people in their own neighborhoods loving each other enough to help.
Chris, you say it was an eye-opening experience. Your perspective, being in and out of jail through the years, now you are 67 years old. What has been the takeaway from your experience in jail?
The last time I was in was 18 years ago in Ramsey County in St. Paul. It was summertime. I got in there and I was one of two Caucasians in amongst maybe 100 inmates. And initially when the lights were on, a lot of the young blacks and Hispanics and whoever were bragging and yipping and yapping about how cool they were and we'll bust out of this blah, blah, blah place. And when the lights went out, they turned the temperature down so it's so cold you're shivering. I heard grown men crying and weeping. Not such big shots, but the minute they get out, then they're cool when they're on the street. Hey, man, I got over on the system. That's where it's got to stop.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for calling in with this personal story. I want to get David to respond. David, go ahead.
Yeah, I appreciate the story, too. I have two thoughts. One is that his story shows that being behind bars for a while can make you less criminal. It's definitely not a black and white thing. The big issue we're facing is that the reason we've got more than 2 million people behind bars now in this country is not because people are spending a few nights in jail, but more like people are spending 2 years in jail for in some cases, prefer fairly small crimes. And so what I'm mostly interested in is what happens when you spend 2 years in jail and what that does to you, as distinct from an overnight, you know, or so that can really teach you a good lesson. The other thing I wanted to say is Chris talked about how what he thought was a key, which is, in a sense, how we're raising people and how we treat our neighbors. I'm sure that there's something to that. However, I think it probably is not the story by itself. Crime in this country has fallen by about half in the last 20 years, both violent crime and property crime. And I'm guessing that that's not because there are half as many families all of a sudden where parents are not loving their children and raising them right. I think there's more going on, which we don't actually understand that well.
You argue in your research that the deterrence impact of long sentences is quite small. Can you break that down for us? Explain how does mandatory minimum sentencing affect society?
Okay. Well, we had a big, one of the most harsh sentencing laws, using what you just mentioned, mandatory minimum sentences, was in California. It started in the early 1990s, and they called it three strikes and you're out. So if you committed one felony, you got the regular sentence. But if you committed a second one, then the sentence was doubled. And on your third one, you could get 25 to life, even if it was a fairly modest felony. And so this was really about escalating the sentences for people who were repeat offenders. And so, I looked at the research on what happened after, and I won't go into the specifics, but there was almost no impact on whether people who were at risk of getting that third strike actually would avoid arrest or avoid crime. Meanwhile, you've got these people who are in prison for 20 years or more for relatively minor drug crimes, and it just seems unjust. In some cases discriminatory, because this is happening more to people of color, and also really expensive for the California taxpayer. And we've had versions of that in a lot of states around the country.
And did these trends bear out across the country?
Well, I don't look at across the country per se. My job was to look at existing research, and most studies look at one place. They look at Chicago or Washington, D.C., or a few states. There are some exceptions to that. So I just have to go with what I what's available to me. The reason is that we're looking for studies that either run actual experiments, like they do when they want to test whether a drug works, where they randomize, or take advantage of, sudden changes in the law in a particular state, which are almost like an experiment, because you have a, overnight change in what's going on. Well, I think maybe what I should explain I found little deterrent effect. That's the before effect. It's clear that laws that have suddenly put a lot more people in prison or a lot fewer people in prison have measurably affected the crime rate in the short run. And when we put a lot more people behind bars, the crime does go down. The problem is that when you look at what happens when they get out, more often than not, it looks like it's backfiring. So people, yes, don't commit as much crime when they're in prison. At least they don't commit crime outside of prison, which is what's captured in the statistics. But then when they get out, because they are more alienated from, society, or they can't get a job because of their criminal record, or their best friends are also criminals, they actually tend to commit more crime. So that's why the overall picture is so discouraging, that we're yes, temporarily reducing crime, but then in the long run, we seem in most cases to be, if you will, manufacturing criminals.
Let's take another call now at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Norm in Milwaukee. Hi, Norm.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I have two comments on this subject. One is that I believe privatizing the jail system is the wrong move. It creates a system where the people that run the system are going to put people in jail just for the purpose of profit. And my second comment is that I had experience with my daughter being in jail for the crime of smoking marijuana. She was in jail for 5 months in the same court system. I worked with a firefighter who committed domestic violence. He discharged a shotgun in his house towards his wife and child who were hiding behind the door, and he got 3 days in a psych ward and was back to work in the fire department just for the sole reason that he hunted with the judge and hunted with the police officers that investigated that charge.
So we're seeing, Norm, you're seeing just quite the disparity in how we punish particular crimes.
Absolutely. And as far as my daughter goes for being in jail, putting her in jail for smoking marijuana, all that did was give her 15 to 20 more contacts of where she could get the drug from.
Let's get David to respond. Go ahead.
Gosh, you know, I think what you say resonates, that there's a lot of craziness both in, you know, what's what the laws say about what crimes get long sentences and what ones get short ones, and then also how they're carried out. And some of that we can't avoid, you know, we're human beings and we're not perfect. Human beings, you know, like including the judges. But I think the example of a long sentence for a relatively minor drug crime is really an important one, because there's been a lot of that going on. I think, I'm not sure it's true anymore, but at one point, you know, the federal law, the federal sentence for drug crimes discriminated between whether the drug was crack or ordinary cocaine, and gave a much higher sentence when it was crack, even though it was pretty much the same drug. And what's interesting is to compare that to how the government is now talking about the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just heard on the radio yesterday the Surgeon General, I think, has declared it a public health emergency. When crack was ravaging American cities in the 1980s, I don't think it was declared a public health emergency. I think actually what happened is the government declared a war on drugs. And so that war was carried out by well-armed police officers using a fairly narrow set of tools, arresting and charging people. And now we're talking about dealing with the opioid epidemic in a very different way. And I have to believe that part of the reason is about race, right? Most of the victims of opioid addiction now are white, whereas the old drug problem from a few generations ago, a generation ago, had more of a black face. And I think that that's something as a society that we need to be talking about a lot more.
If you're just joining us, we are with David Rudman. He's a senior advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project, which is based in California. And he recently released a long report titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime. David, Jean from Madison called in, but she couldn't stay with us, and asked, how do you avoid your own bias when reviewing the research?
Oh, that's a great question. I can't avoid it completely because I'm human. And what I want to emphasize is that the grant making that my organization is doing, although I'm not personally involved in the grant making, is based on the view that we ought to have fewer people in prison. And so there's some, you know, it's easier for me to get along with my coworkers if I come to the same conclusion. But I did a few things, especially when it came to doing a cost-benefit analysis, like actually tallying up what we're getting out of the system and the good and the bad side, where I tried to set up a devil's advocate interpretation of my results. I said there's some studies where you could read it this way or that way. So I'm going to actually present two overall takes on the evidence, and then do both of them. And I found, and then even when I there's a couple layers of that. And so when I constructed my devil's advocate case, the one that disagreed, was most uncomfortable for me and my organization, I still found that putting people in prison where we are today was not doing society net good. So I found that, yeah, in the devil's advocate view, putting more people in prison was reducing crime a bit, but not enough to justify depriving people of liberty and spending making taxpayers pay for all those prisons.
Norm, thanks for the call. Let's go to Joe now in Nathan. Hi, Joe. Go ahead.
Hi. Good morning, David. I thank you for giving me the opportunity to. I haven't admittedly followed your whole discussion, but there seems to be a piece of statistical pie missing here, and that's the relevance of the juvenile justice system. And having had the benefit of being on both sides of the fence, that being an offender and also working in the Department of Corrections, you know, it's been my experience that to a large degree, the sentencing, at least in Wisconsin, mandates at least the inmate achieve a high school diploma, which he never, ever would have likely accomplished without being prosecuted and sentenced. But just to digress here, there was a caller who previously broached on the subject about single-parent families. And if I could allude to the relevance of, and which is my experience, and I found a similar experience in a great degree, that being offenders simply offend to get out of the social situation that they find themselves in. Oftentimes there is no outlet for that need other than to, at some level, consciously offend.
Well, Joe, thank you for bringing these two threads here to the table. David, the first thread here, a high school diploma, and then this second idea, offenders just offending to get out of a situation.
Really, I don't have much special knowledge on either of these questions.
Mm-hmm.
My job was to review the mathematics in a set of studies with a very clear focus. What it did remind me of is the important thought that I don't think it's black and white when we ask whether having been either in the juvenile or the adult correction system makes you more likely to commit crime later. I think it really depends on how these facilities are run, at least in part. So some of the stuff, I did look at juvenile studies, or four or five good ones that I thought were worthy of attention. Most of them found that when, teenagers were put into some kind of facility for a month, say, they came out less likely to graduate from high school, less likely to get a good job, more likely to commit crime. But it wasn't uniform. There was one important exception, I think, in Washington State. And I think that shows us that it really can really depend on how these facilities are run. I think it's a bit like parenting. You can really screw up a kid and therefore harm society, or you can help them get on the straight and narrow. And it's not black and white, but I was reading reports of a particular facility in Wisconsin. I've forgotten the name.
Lincoln Hills.
Lincoln Hills, yeah, where there's been reports of abuse and actually violence, maybe in both directions, between the kids who are there and the adults who are controlling them. And it doesn't seem like a good situation. I don't know the specifics, but it doesn't seem like it's one that's going to make these kids contributing members of society when they get out.
We're talking right now with David Rudman. He is a senior advisor to the grant-making organization Open Philanthropy Project. It's based in San Francisco, and he has been working on examining incarceration in America, looking at the math behind a lot of the research that is out there. You can join this conversation. Do you think incarceration reduces crime? Why or why not? 800-642-1234. Do you think America has a sentencing problem? Join in or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll return after a check of the news here on the Ideas Network. Decarceration movement and the Smart Decarceration Initiative, they're gaining strength and traction from lawmakers and grant award agencies, and we're hearing the anecdotal evidence from formerly incarcerated people and their families. The evidence, or the puzzle pieces, if you will, for prison reform seem to be falling into place. But David Rudman wanted to test the evidence to see if decarceration, having not as many people locked up, would make our country safer or more vulnerable to crime. And David is with us this hour. He's senior advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project. He recently released a report titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime. You can join the conversation, post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. What do you think of David's findings? Do you think decarceration would help the U.S. with punishing options? Join in 800-642-1234. Let's go to Jenny now, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, good morning, David. Thank you for taking my call. I work in the public school system, which is often accused of being the school-to-prison pipeline. I was very interested in your comments that you just made about the juvenile detention system and whether or not that deters future crime. I agree that's pretty bleak. My question is if in your research you've come across any data regarding children who have had parents incarcerated, and whether or not growing up with that experience has deterred those children from going on to be criminals and to end up incarcerated themselves?
That's a great question for which I don't have a great answer, because no, I did not look much at that, and I don't know if it has been studied much. But I think it is good to raise it because it can be one of the ways that, you know, the idea of being tough on crime can actually backfire, right? If you take somebody out of a family and put him or her in prison for a couple of years, does that disrupt the family in a way that actually leads to more crime down the road? And that's important for us to be thinking about that. The tough on crime idea is appealing, and there's some truth to it, but it's also not the whole picture.
Jenny, thank you so much for calling in. Let's go to David now in Madison. Hi, David.
Oh, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First of all, I think obviously step one is we need to end the drug war. I think we can all agree on that, or all sensible people anyway. But beyond that, I want to echo what a couple of the earlier callers have said about the critical role of parenting. And I'd like to cite an interesting statistical study in support of that. Maybe about 15 years ago, a book came out called Freakonomics. And it also noted this drastic drop in crime starting in the 90s. And it's connected that with the legalization of abortion in 1973. Beginning in 1973, all kinds of unwanted babies weren't being born, and they would have come of age around the early 90s and very likely would have been criminals, because unwanted, poorly raised children are much more likely to be criminals. So anyway, well, I'm wondering if your author, your guest has read that book and what his take is on that theory.
David, thanks so much. And it sounds like David here is singling out one variable and then seeing if you can apply it to make a conclusion.
Yeah. So the guy behind Freakonomics, at least the economist guy, is a man named Stephen Levitt, who's an economist at University of Chicago. And as a young professor, he really burst onto the scene of economics with some clever studies, just like the one that you mentioned, where he seemed to show that making abortion legal led to crime reductions a generation later, right? That particular study, I think, has been substantially debunked. Somebody did kind of what I've been doing to that particular study and found some errors in how the numbers were run. And when those were corrected, the result pretty much went away. Now, probably Stephen Levitt would argue that, but I think most economists believe that he lost that argument, that he had a clever idea and actually there were mistakes in what he did. But I looked in carefully at another of his studies, and I corresponded with him about what I found. In that particular one, I think he was mostly right, that right after you put a bunch of people in prison, crime goes down in that first year. And although I think he probably... when I redo his numbers, I become much less certain of it. I think he's probably right, but I don't have the confidence that he had.
Well, David, thanks for calling in. And let's go to Mike in Germantown now. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Mike.
The issue that I have is, all these procedures and plans are probably good in one way and not good in the other way. I listen to your radio station in regards to many different subjects. The problem I have with it, though, is that we never, I've never, in any different subject, we never attack the root cause.
And so, Mike, let's get to it. What do you think is the root cause here on this incarceration discussion?
The root cause is we have a society based on lies, greed, fake. And when you have a society based on those values, what do you expect?
So, and what I think, Mike, I'm hearing here is there are bigger societal problems, David. And, you know, when you do run the numbers and do the math, how do you wrap your arms around those bigger societal issues?
Well, at some point, I mean, you're absolutely right that nothing here is simple. Everything you could propose is going to be good in some ways and bad in others. I just try to be very pragmatic. Yes, it would be great if we knew all the root causes and could just fix them, but usually we can't. So what can we actually do, and what should we expect about whether it'll make a difference or not? I would say, you know, as I mentioned before, crime in this country has fallen by about half in the last 20 years, and I don't think it's because there's been a big change in how greedy or devout we are. I think there's something probably a little less, you know, a little more mundane going on that we ought to understand better.
So after your research, do you view prison reform through a different lens? Have you been changed by this research?
Yeah, because I take a long time to be, I guess I bring a lot of the skepticism of the last caller to pretty much anything. It's like, yeah, you can say whatever you want, but it'll work in some ways and not in others. And now I'm much more confident that we ought to be finding ways to not send people to prison for so long, that we're just shooting ourselves in the foot.
How optimistic are you about prison reform in the U.S.? Do you see the grants being made to work on it, to chip away at it?
We are making lots of grants, supporting lots of organizations around the country, mostly working at the state level. And I do think that, I am optimistic in this area. I don't follow it in detail. I can't speak to it, you know, in great detail. But the reason we're in this is that we see potentials for left-right coalitions on this issue. You know, whether people are concerned about the taxpayer costs or about the tendency to put more people of color behind bars or any of the other major issues that surround this, people across the political spectrum are interested in decarceration now. It's gotten locked up in Congress, but at the state level, a lot is happening.
And let's try to fit in one more question here. Let's go to Daryl with a question about white-collar crime. Go ahead, Daryl.
Yes, and listening the entire hour to this program, which I appreciate, I'm wondering why I haven't heard any reference made by the callers or the guest to white-collar crime, which I believe is way more intrusive on the general public.
Go ahead, as we are drawing to a close here, David. How would you address white-collar crime?
You're right. I absolutely didn't focus on that and that as much, and partly that's because the studies I read have not, and it is something that deserves more attention. I would say what people worry about first is their own safety. You know, they worry about robbery and violent attacks and home invasion, this kind of thing. And while it sucks to have your credit card stolen, it's not the same as being mugged on the street.
Daryl, thank you so much for calling in. And as we start to wrap up here, David, is there any research out there that you have an eye on that you're watching for that could, you know, have some significance in how we understand incarceration or de-incarceration for that matter?
What I want to understand better is why it seems like in some cases prisons are actually helping people reintegrate with society. The best study example I've seen this unfortunately comes from Norway, but there may be examples here as well. And then help us understand why other prisons are doing the opposite. It's because it is not 100% one way or the other, and we need to understand better how we actually run the prisons that we have, because we're still going to need to have prisons. And there's still going to be people living in them, and we want to help them do better when they get out.
And so, speaking of Norway, then, how is crime in prison in other countries in comparison to this country? And should we be looking at some key takeaways from what neighboring countries are doing?
Oh, sure. We should learn from wherever we can. In the case of Norway, they seem to be doing a good job of providing people with job training and even helping them, you know, like in a kind of internship approach, help them do work while in prison that can lead directly to a job when they get out. And then when they get those jobs, they're much less likely to break the law.
And you're finding that the research is supportive of that, that you see the research in other countries as what is happening in the U.S.?
Absolutely, sure, in this case.
Well, David, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be here.
David Rudman is Senior Advisor at the Open Philanthropy Project, which is based in San Francisco, and he spent a year on it. He recently released a report titled The Impacts of Incarceration on Crime, and we can continue this conversation about decarceration and incarceration over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This hour of the morning show was produced by Niaja Ellison. Michelle Johnson provided technical direction. She's executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network. Coming up tomorrow at this time, we'll discuss how early detection of lung cancer is helping save the lives of high-risk current and former smokers. That's this time tomorrow. Stay with us. Thanks for listening.